At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
You are listening to continuing coverage of the trial of Chad Daybell from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Let's go back to the courtroom.
So coming back to fall, winter of 2018, if it's fair to say that your testimony, your wife's religious fervor has changed, and you had this awkward Christmas party, is that fair to say?
Yes.
Did the situation... and you testified that your relationship between the Chad and Lori family and your family was close. Did the situation between your family and Charles and Lori's family change around that time?
A little bit after. Right after, in the new year, beginning of the new year, there was a period where Lori... She did send a message to the family telling them that her accusation was Charles was cheating on her, and that because of this she locked she took all the money out of their bank account, she stole Charles's truck, changed the locks on their house. It was very irrational to me.
And when was this?
It would have been like the end of January of 2019.
And how did you respond to that situation?
Initially I didn't even know about it. I think she called everybody, but my phone was blocked from Charles, so I couldn't hear from him at all. I found out later that Melanie must have blocked him in my phone. But
just to be clear, Charles Vallow's contact was blocked on your phone?
Yes, and I didn't do it. And the only other person who had access was my wife.
Okay. And so... you were talking about how you reacted to this situation of, I guess you could say, a breakup between Lori and Charles.
Yeah, it's a tough one when you're that close with people, and everybody in the family kind of got drug in and involved in it because, it was messy. As far as like. Charles really didn't want it to happen. He wasn't looking for it. He was trying to make sure it didn't happen. He was sending us as a group regular emails to try to contact us and work through it and try to communicate, because Lori just kind of cut him off after all that. She just stopped talking to him. She actually left him with JJ and just disappeared for a while.
Do you know where she went?
I don't.
Right. But she didn't take JJ with her?
No.
Do you know how old JJ was at the time?
I can't remember right now. It's been a long time.
But he was still a young child.
Yeah, I mean, you couldn't leave JJ. JJ had to be watched all the time. You couldn't leave him alone. He was, when you're watching JJ, it's your whole life. Like, you have to plan everything around it. I mean, just for him to come visit, you have to plan everything around it.
And you stated that the whole family got drug in. Did your wife take a position on taking a side?
When it happened, I wanted us to not take a side, and divorces are just messy, you know, like there's nothing anybody can do about, like when you've been together for a long time and you're trying to separate both emotionally, gonna have a hard time going through the process. And so my encouragement was that we didn't pick a side. We just loved them both and then made sure that the kids knew that they had somewhere where they could be safe. And, you know, our house could be that. But Melanie was just kept saying how she was uncomfortable with Charles and she didn't.
Microphone, please. We're getting into some hearsay, and Judge, I've been patient, but the narrative is getting a little lengthy now, so I'm going to object on narrative and hearsay at this point.
Sustain.
Okay. Did Melanie Boudreau demand that your family take a side?
Objection, hearsay.
That's a request, Your Honor. A request is not hearsay.
That is overruled. You can answer.
Yes, she did.
And did you respect Melanie's wishes on that?
I did my best.
And was that because she was your wife?
Yeah, I wanted to stay married. It was really important to me.
And so we've kind of moved on now to the beginning of 2019. Is that accurate to say?
Yes.
In these events that you're talking about?
Yeah.
Did you see Lori Vallow much in early of 2019?
Not at all.
Okay. And I believe, I don't want to misstate what you said. It was your understanding that she had left.
Yeah, I don't know where, because I didn't have any contact and it didn't seem like anyone else did, but.
Did you see Charles Vallow at all during that time?
I did a few times. We would agree for JJ to come over, play with my kids. And so he would come over.
Okay. And Lori was never with him?
Never.
And was she with JJ?
No.
But Charles would come over and bring JJ to the house?
Yeah.
And what would JJ do at your house?
He would just come play with my son. He would, they'd play video games as long as he could keep his attention on it. Sometimes he'd just bounce from one thing to another and be all over the house. Braxton would kind of keep his eye on him and play with him. He knew JJ was special. And so he kind of kept that assignment. Before JJ came over, he'd prep, you know, we put like little stoppers on the top of the all the doors out or whatever to make sure he would try to sneak outside. And then it was, I mean, he's so fast that you had to be prepared. So you'd pre-plan some of that stuff before he came over, make sure it was ready for him. And then, but Braxton would kind of keep his eye on him. And I would usually at that time, I'd sit and talk to Charles.
Okay. What would you speak with Charles about?
You can imagine someone going through a divorce they didn't want to go through. He was pretty, I don't know what the right words are, distraught, sad, overwhelmed. It was a lot for him.
Are you aware if at any time there was an attempt at reconciliation between Charles and Lori?
Yeah, I think Charles tried to reconcile. I actually think he stopped at the divorce. He always said that he was going to make it work.
Sustain.
I'm going to move forward to the summer of 2019. Did you have an occasion to take a trip to your in-law's house?
I did, yeah.
And do you recall when that was?
It would have been in June of 2018.
Do you recall the exact date or approximately when in June?
The week of June, like 23rd, 25th, something like that.
What was your purpose for going to your in-laws?
My wife's younger sister was getting married.
And while you were there, did anything out of the ordinary happen?
Yes.
What was that?
A few things, but the first thing that happened is my grandfather died of a heart attack.
And were you expecting that?
No.
And so you're at your wife's family's house when you got the news?
I was actually with my parents. We took my family, went to, decided to go to church with my mom and my dad, which is they still live in the same place where I had left for my mission on. And we were actually just sitting in the pews right before church started. And my dad got a phone call, and he never gets up and takes his phone calls in church. So he got up and he left. And he came back and he waved us all out, said.
Your Honor, this is, I apologize.
Go ahead. It's sustained, as you're saying.
It's just some foundation. So I can move on at this point.
Very well.
Did you have any conversations about your grandfather's death with your wife, Melanie?
Yes. After he passed away, I waited a day or two. My mom called me to tell me when the funeral was. And I told her that I, when it was and that I wanted us all to go, and she told me she wasn't going to go.
Sustained. And I'll strike that final part of the response, what was said.
All right. At this point, were you still at your in-law's home?
Yes.
And did you have a disagreement with your wife over whether or not to attend your grandfather's funeral?
Yes.
Did you want to go to your father's funeral? Your grandfather's funeral?
Overruled. You can continue, Mr. Wood.
Yes, I wanted to go to my grandfather's funeral, and I wanted my family to.
While you were having this discussion with your wife, did that escalate into any other type of conversation?
Yes. It escalated into a conversation in an argument that didn't make any sense to me.
What was it about?
Well, she started bringing Lori into this argument, which had nothing to do with what we were talking about. She said that God had...
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. It's hearsay.
You're right.
Response, Mr. Wood.
Your Honor, I believe it comes in for the effect on the listener, not for the truth of the matter.
Well, I think just the specific statements are hearsay beyond that, so I'll sustain the objection.
Right. Without saying what your wife, the words your wife used, what was the context of that conversation?
We had an argument about whether or not I hacked Lori Vallow's computer.
Did your wife accuse you of hacking Lori Vallow's computer?
Yes.
Did she request that you admit that you hacked into her computer?
Yes, she said that I had to.
Judge, I'm going to object again.
Your Honor.
Sustain.
Your Honor, if I might briefly argue, a request is not hearsay.
Well, a request, if it's calling for specific statements of the party not here for cross, would be hearsay. So I'm not saying you can't answer, but in terms of specifically what was said, that's where the ruling stands.
All right. Thank you. So there was that accusation was made.
Yes.
What was your reaction to that?
I just felt really frustrated. I had no idea why we were even talking about it. It had nothing to do with what we were trying, what I was trying to get through to her and what I was trying to talk about. It was like this thing that didn't make any sense to me.
Without going into any specific statements, did Melanie Boudreaux provide any context for why she thought you'd hacked into Lori Vallow's computer?
Judge, it's going to call for hearsay.
Overruled.
Can you ask that question one more time?
Yeah. Without providing any of the statements she said, did Melanie Boudreaux provide any context for why she thought or why she was accusing you of hacking into Lori Vallow's computer?
Can you ask that one more time? I want to answer it properly.
Sorry, it's probably complicated.
Yeah.
Was there any reason given why she thought you had hacked into Lori Vallow's computer?
Judge, response calls for hearsay.
Overruled.
No.
Just a bare accusation.
Yeah.
To be clear, Mr. Boudreaux, did you ever hack into Lori Vallow's computer?
No.
Did, in this conversation, did Melanie Boudreaux inform you of anything that God had revealed to her,
Judge,
in relation to this divorce?
Judge, I'm going to object. This is leading.
On leading, that's overruled.
Yeah, the argument continued to progress. And I guess she actually specifically said that God had told her.
Judge, I'm going to object. It's hearsay.
It is hearsay.
Your Honor, this statement is not coming in for the truth of the matter. It's just simply to show the argument and the effect on the listener.
All right. And again, for that purpose, it's not hearsay, but any specific statements where they're not subject to cross, I'm finding are hearsay.
Yeah. Without saying the specific statement she said, what did she accuse you of?
Of being gay and of hacking her Aunt Lori's computer.
And what was your response to those accusations?
I mean, all of the emotions you would think you'd feel after 10 years of married to somebody. Disappointment, frustration, a lot of grief, a lot of grief.
Did you have any idea that she would make an accusation of homosexuality against you?
No. I mean, I had a thought that it might happen because of something Charles had said, but no, I never would have believed it.
So you have, is it fair to call it an argument?
Yeah.
How did it end?
I mean, it took a long time. It started in the afternoon. It went past midnight, and she went to bed. I just stayed up troubled all night.
Okay. Did you send a text to Charles and Lori that night?
I did. I was really frustrated about this whole thing being involved in my relationship with my wife. So I sent it.
It's becoming a narrative. It's non-responsive.
Overruled.
So I sent a text to Charles and Lori both, telling them that if my family was broken up and my marriage ruined, it was on them.
Did you ever hear from Lori in response to that?
No.
Yeah. Did you hear from Charles in response to that?
I did.
When approximately was that?
A little bit later. A lot was going on at that time, so I couldn't say like a specific time, but I ended up talking to him on the phone.
Would you say this? Is it fair to say we're still in the late June?
Yeah, it was like the next day, probably at like in the evening.
Right. And what was that conversation like?
He just apologized for
Judge, I'm going to object at this point. It's calling for hearsay.
Sustain.
What did you say to Charles?
I just apologized to him. Told him I was really sorry about not being there more for him, because now I was feeling like I know he must have felt. He was really gracious.
Was that the last time you spoke with Charles Vallo?
It was.
After Charles Vallo died, did you have any contact with Lori Vallo?
No, I did not.
After Charles died, did you have any contact with JJ Vallo?
No, I did not.
And after Charles died, did you have any contact with Tylee Ryan?
No, I did not.
After Charles Vallo died, what happened with your relationship with your wife?
We got divorced.
When did that happen, approximately?
We started the divorce right after my grandfather's funeral, but it takes a little while. So we got a mediator right after and signed all the documents, and I moved her into a rental house. And then I think it finalized in October.
Okay. In that process, was there any, the home that you and Melanie lived in, did you sell it?
I did.
And did she move to another location?
She did. I helped her get a rental home.
Right. And did you move to another location?
I did. I ended up getting a rental home as well.
Approximately when did you get that rental home?
I got it. I found out the house was sold, like the end of September. It looked like it was going to sell. And so I went and found a rental home at that time.
Right. And where was... don't go into specifics of neighborhoods, but what city was this in?
Gilbert, Arizona.
Okay. And is that where you had been living the last several years?
Yeah, I moved back.
And so did you, you located a property that, was it close to the home that you and Melanie had been living in?
Yes.
And why was that?
I wanted to make sure my kids had stability. I was really worried about all the changes.
And were you sharing custody with Melanie at this time?
I was.
What was the situation between you and Melanie like at this point, at the end of September, beginning of October of 2019?
It had changed quite a bit. Since June, she just stopped talking to me. We could text, but barely. There was no connection anymore. And she's very cold to me.
At this point, did you know where Lori Vallo was?
No.
Is it fair to say that probably wasn't the first thing on your mind?
Yeah.
But you hadn't heard from her?
No.
And you hadn't heard from Tylee or JJ?
No.
So we've been speaking about this, your situation with your wife, Melanie Boudreau, at the end of September, beginning of October. Did anything happen at the beginning of October of 2019 that affected that situation?
Yes.
What was that?
On October 2nd of 2019, someone parked in front of my house and shot at me and tried to kill me.
Okay. Let's talk about that. October 2nd, you said?
Yes.
Let's go to the kind of the beginning of the day. How did your day start?
I woke up. I had all my kids at my house. So I got them ready for school. And then I got them out the door. We did our normal stuff, breakfast, prayer. And then I dropped the older two at school. And the younger one, the second youngest at a preschool. And then I dropped my youngest at Melanie's house.
After you dropped your kids off, where did you go next?
Then I went to the gym.
This is all in that same area, Gilbert, Arizona?
Yes.
And after the gym, where did you go?
Then I drove back to my house. And as I was driving around, my house is a couple of houses in on the street. So I made a left in onto the street. And as I was driving, I noticed a few things. My house, the driveway, there was like a Jeep parked right on the edge of it, where I would normally turn in, and there was nothing parked there usually. I'd only been there for a few days, but so far it was always, there was this van there, and like the Jeep was parked with its like bumper basically on the van. And it just looked at that place. It had a Texas license plate. There was no tire on the back of the Jeep. And you know how when you open and close a Jeep, there's like little tabs on the window. Those were sitting on the outside of it. So it just looked awkward. You know, just was awkward enough that I noticed it right as I turned around the corner.
Okay. So you noticed the Jeep. Mm-hmm. Did you notice anybody inside of it?
I couldn't tell if there was anybody inside of it. You know, this all happened in such, imagine coming around a corner, driving a couple house lengths. So it all happened very quickly. And then the window opened up and I saw a gun and a silencer. And my window shattered. I heard a bang, you know, all kind of in the same amount of time. And my immediate thought was just, I'm getting shot at. And I, instead of turning my wheel and into my driveway, I just pushed the gas and drove straight forward.
What happened after that?
I drove to where my street ended, and there was a turn. And kind of as I came up to that part, I remember grabbing my phone, calling 911, talking to the operator. I went and pulled a little bit around, and there was like a little community pool there, and I kind of parked in front of it for a second. And there's like a loop between my street and the street above me. And I remember I could see on that loop, I saw that Jeep start to come around the corner, and then it did a U-turn and went the other way. And I think I started to follow it at first. And then I think
were you on the phone with 911 during this time?
Yes. Yeah. The whole time I was talking to an operator.
And you just said, if I understand correctly, that you started following the Jeep.
Yeah, I don't know what I was thinking. At the moment, but
did you notify 911 that's what you were doing?
Yeah, and they told I believe they told me to pull around and park in front of my house. So I did, and then they told me to wait for police, and they came shortly thereafter.
Okay. I believe you testified. Correct me if I'm wrong. That you had only been in this house for a few days.
Yes.
How many people had you told that you were in this house?
Almost nobody. It would happen very quickly because I wasn't supposed to be able to get my kids as soon as I was, but my wife had agreed to let me have them sooner. And so I had moved everything out of the house that was selling to get them in so I could have them for that weekend with me in my house, because I would do anything to keep my kids with me.
Melanie Boudreau, you were there. Had you told anybody else?
So I had to tell her when I got the place. I hadn't told anybody else, but my neighbors had seen me moving and they helped me move. So anyway, it was just the ones that lived by me there.
So you, had you told any other friends and family yet this was your new residence?
Just hadn't had time to tell anybody yet. It was so quick. And I had my kids.
So did law enforcement show up?
Yes.
And did you notify them of what had happened?
Yeah, I told them everything that I could.
And when you said your window had shattered, is that your driver's side front window?
Yes, the bullet had lodged up in like the door frame, which I didn't know in the moment, but later you could see where it had hit. And it was just right above like where my head would be.
Right. And did you describe the Jeep to law enforcement?
Yes.
And did you follow up with law enforcement after that?
Yes. When you go through something like that, you spend all day, it feels like, with law enforcement. It takes a really long time. So at some point, like, a detective came over and I talked to him. And then later, as I was thinking through everything and talking with other people that were close to it, I realized that I felt really confident that the Jeep was Tylee's Jeep.
Okay, so let's talk about that. Were you aware that Tylee Ryan had a Jeep?
Yes.
Did you know how long she'd had it?
Charles got it for her during all of this, when he was in Texas, he'd gotten her Jeep.
So when he was in Texas, was that in 2019?
Yes.
Okay. And you had seen that Jeep?
Yes.
Right. And so I don't want to put words in your mouth, your testimony is that as you reflected on it, you thought more and more that this was Tylee's Jeep.
Yeah, I think I might have called Zach Cox and talked to him too, and he might have had the same thought, and we both were just like, that's got to be the Jeep.
Who is Zach Cox?
Adam Cox, Lori's brother. It's his son. He had lived with Lori and Charles for a period of time, and with me. He's 18, 19 at the time, so he just kind of out on his own. He was working for me. I had given him a job.
Did you take any other steps to identify that Jeep?
I was an insurance agent at the time, and previously Charles had given us the VIN number, and so I just gave that VIN number to law enforcement.
Okay. So you have the VIN number for Tylee Ryan's Jeep?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. And that's the number you provided to law enforcement?
Yeah.
And just to be clear, you had that because you were insuring that Jeep?
I didn't end up insuring it. He had just given us all the information, Charles had.
Okay.
So,
Your Honor, I don't know what time the court wants to take the mid-morning break.
This is probably about a good time to do it, Mr. Wood.
Okay.
All right, so we will take our mid-morning recess. Remind the jurors, please, not to discuss the case amongst yourselves on the break or with anyone else. We will return to the courtroom here in about 30 minutes, maybe a little less if we can.
All right, please. That's just your court sound session.
Thank you. Please be seated. All right, Mr. Bailiff, we could have the jurors return, please.
Your Honor, if the state and defense could just briefly confer with you.
Yes. Okay, we can have the jurors brought in.
He's going to let me. Here's our present counsel, Your Honor.
All right, thank you. Please be seated. All right, we're back on the record on CR 2221-1623, State of Idaho versus Chad Guy Daybell, continuing direct examination of Mr. Boudreaux, who's still under oath for testimony. I'll remind the witness, the jurors have returned, and Mr. Wood, you can continue with your direct.
Thank you. Mr. Boudreaux, when we left off, we were discussing an incident on October 2nd. And again, I don't want to put words in your mouth. It sounds like you testified you had come to some opinion as to which Jeep was involved. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. And you provided the VIN number of Tylee Ryan's Jeep to law enforcement?
Yes.
Your Honor, I'm going to ask state be allowed to publish State's Exhibit 9A.
As previously admitted, correct?
Yes.
Yes, you may publish it.
Mr. Boudreaux, do you recognize that vehicle?
Yes.
you know who that vehicle belonged to?
We called it Tylee's Jeep. I believe it was Charles's. I think he's the one who bought it.
But you were aware that Tylee Ryan drove that Jeep?
Yes.
Okay. Is that the Jeep that you saw on the morning of October 2nd, 2019?
Yes.
So as you provided that VIN to law enforcement, did you do anything else in regards to that shooting?
That day or when specifically?
Well, let's start with that day. Did you do anything else? When approximately did you give law enforcement the VIN number for Tylee Ryan's Jeep?
That day.
Okay. And did you take any other steps or did you provide any other information to law enforcement?
I just shared with them who I thought did it and why.
All right. At any point after that first day, did you do anything else looking into the shooting that took place?
Yes.
What did you do?
After you go through something like that, it was pretty traumatic. It took me a little bit to realize that that a resolution wasn't just going to come really quick. Like the police weren't just going to arrest someone, you know, a day or two later, and then it would all be resolved. So I started trying to figure out things I could do to help assist law enforcement into finding who shot at me. That included hiring a private investigator, going back through any information I had, like old emails, the ones that Charles had sent me.
Okay, so let's talk about that. You said Charles had sent you some emails. When had Charles sent you emails?
He sent me emails. So when he and Lori were going through the divorce, he was sending out emails to the family with things he was concerned about, because he was very concerned about her mental health and with things that pertain to this belief set that she was building.
Okay. And so that was during the period that Charles and Lori were separated. Is that accurate?
Yes.
Okay. And were you the only recipient of those emails?
No, he sent it to all of our family. So any of us who he considered family. So like Janice, Barry, Zach, Adam, all of us.
And so it's your testimony, you started going back through those emails.
I did, yes.
And what was the purpose of that?
I thought maybe if I knew more about what these beliefs were that now apparently to me it seemed my wife had and Lori had, that I could maybe I could try to figure out more of what was going on, because everything was so bizarre.
And these emails that Charles sent, what was the nature of these emails? Was it a narrative that he was speaking about?
Well, in them I found that a lot of the stuff was being sent by a Chad Daybell, who I didn't know.
Okay. And when you say stuff, what type of stuff?
There was like these documents that talked about like light and dark spirits, and it was like rating my family, like myself and then my extended family, like Lori's family and things like that. There was invitations to some of these firesides and stuff like that, and information about them that I didn't consider firesides, things like that.
Okay. And did you provide those emails to law enforcement?
I did, yeah.
And did you see your own name written in those emails?
I did.
With some type of, did you understand what that was? Like you said some type of rating. How did you know?
I'm going to object. This is becoming leading. And we haven't had a sufficient foundation to tell us what emails, date, time, place, year.
It's sustained as leading.
Okay. You had testified that you saw your name.
Yes.
Was there anything written next to your name?
A letter D.
Okay. After you provided those emails to law enforcement, did you do anything else?
I wanted to figure out more, so I got into Google and searched for Chad Daybell, because I didn't know him. So I wanted to see more information about this person that was sending. the information.
Right. And what did you find?
When I typed his name in, an obituary popped up for a Tammany Daybell. And something inside of me was just shocked. I was just...
Did you provide that information to law enforcement?
I did, yes. I called up my detective, Ryan Piller, at the time, and I texted him.
Just to clarify, you said my detective. Was that your private investigator or a law enforcement detective?
Sorry. Yes, he was the detective at Gilbert at the time that was assigned to my case.
Right. As this process went on, did you ever learn that Ty Lee, Ryan, and JJ Vallow were missing?
Yes. We were worried about it early on, and I often told Detective Piller my concerns.
Did you ever learn whether or not JJ and Tylee Ryan had been found?
Did.
I'm sorry?
I did. Sorry.
And do you remember when that was?
I got a call June 9th of 2020.
Where were you?
In my parents' house.
Do you remember who called you?
I don't. I just remember somebody from, I think, Rexburg. Calling just to let me know that they had found what they were pretty sure was the kids.
Huh. Once you got that information, what did you do?
The next day was my wedding. So I was getting remarried. So I got married. And shortly after that, I just felt like I needed to go up to Rexburg. I don't know what for. I just felt like I should, so I drove up there.
When you were in Idaho, did law enforcement ask you to do anything as it related to JJ or Tylee?
Yes, they asked me to identify JJ.
And do you recall where you were when that happened?
Where I was when I identified JJ?
Yes.
Okay. It was, I think, outside of Pocatello at an FBI location.
And do you recall the date?
June 11th or June 12th.
Okay. How did they have you identify him?
They showed me some pictures of him deceased. They asked me if that was JJ. And I said, yeah.
Your Honor, I have no further questions at this time.
All right. Cross-examination.
Need a moment?
No, I'm okay. We can go.
You mentioned you had contact with Charles Vallow and Lori Vallow quite frequently. Is that right?
Yes.
What was the frequency with which you had contact with Charles Vallow from... when you first met him to the time of his death?
It varied by the years. Sometimes when he lived close to me, I'd see him often, you know, I could see him every week at some times. And then there was other times where, you know, he traveled for work, so I might not see him for a couple months, and they also lived further away. So sometimes I wouldn't see him as often.
They were nomadic. They never owned a house. They would just constantly rent. That's what I recall. I think you testified to that. Is that right?
I wouldn't use the word nomadic, but they definitely moved more often than I did.
Okay. And approximately the date you first met Lori Vallow?
It would have been in 2008. I was driving with my then fiance at the time from Texas to Utah, and we went through Phoenix, and I met the Cox family at that time.
Okay. And would you agree with me that Lori Vallow and Alex Cox had a very, very close relationship?
It was on again, off again. There was times where it was very close, and there was times when they wouldn't see each other very often, but they knew each other very well.
Well, are you aware that it seemed that every time Lori moved, Alex would follow her and move to where she would move to?
Not always. Yes, sometimes that did happen, but other times, no.
And more often than not, though?
It depended. Like, there were times where Alex lived with in Arizona with us, and Lori left to Hawaii for a few years. But then there was other times I agree with you where, right. You know, they all moved from Texas to Arizona together and things like that.
And on the subject of Hawaii, during the time that Lori left JJ with Charles for that 2 month period, and I believe that was January and February of 19, does that ring a bell?
Yeah, it might have gone into March a little bit too, but yeah, that time frame sounds right.
And during that time, are you aware that she was residing and staying in Hawaii?
I don't know where she lived at that time. I didn't have any contact with her.
Okay. And at the time you were married to her niece, so you guys didn't discuss Lori's whereabouts as being in Hawaii for 2.5 months.
Well, my wife said she didn't know where she was.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if that was true. I just know that's what she said.
Okay. Now, would you agree with me that Tylee and JJ had a very, very close relationship?
Yeah, I mean, they were brother and sister, so I would say they were close.
Well, more than that, isn't it true that for all practical purposes, Tylee was really like the second mother to JJ and caring for JJ?
It depended. I mean, she was a teenager, so there was definitely times where that wasn't the case. But there was also times where she was a nurturer for JJ. I mean, she loved him, but she was, like I said, she's a teenager, so that was not her primary responsibility for sure.
But did you observe JJ looking at that in maybe a different perspective, that he relied on Tylee for a lot of things and things that maybe Lori wasn't providing for him?
Objection calls for speculation.
Overruled.
Did you observe anything to that effect?
And JJ was special needs, so I don't know that I could have identified that JJ could have. I mean, JJ needed every adult or anyone who was there to help him. You know, that's what he needed. And I definitely remember during that time when Charles had him, he missed his mom a lot. And Charles brought it up in those same emails a lot, and it broke your heart.
And after Lori got back from Hawaii in March, early March, there was an attempt at reconciliation.
Yeah, they did try.
And at that point, did Charles confide in you that he actually was convinced by Lori to make Lori the beneficiary of his life insurance policy again?
Charles didn't talk to me about his life insurance policy. Charles did not talk to me about his life insurance policy.
So he never discussed with you finances or anything like that?
We talked about financial stuff, but he never talked to me about his life insurance policy.
Okay. So you're not aware that the life insurance policy was placed in Lori Vallow's name during this reconciliation period then, correct?
I would have no ability to testify to
okay.
that.
Okay. You brought up the subject of Melanie Gibb, and my recollection of your testimony is that you found it unusual that Melanie Gibb was there for Christmas of 2018.
Yes.
And I can't recall if you had said that they seemed to have a close bond at that point. How would you characterize their bond at that point?
Who's they?
Melanie Gibb and Lori Vallow.
Okay. Yeah, it seemed like they definitely had a closer bond.
And are you aware of when Melanie Gibb and Lori first met?
I can't testify to when they met.
Did your wife participate in these gatherings in August, September, and October with Melanie Gibb and Lori?
I believe so.
Yeah. And these gatherings in August, September, and October of 2018 were what you described as these fireside chats?
And I think they went past October. I think they were in November as well, in December. But
they started in the mid to early summer of that year. Is that right?
I can't say when Melanie's very first one was.
Okay. And were you aware that Melanie Gibb was the organizer and planner of all of these events?
I can't testify who planned them.
Okay. It wasn't your wife who was planning them?
I don't think so. It would have been without my knowledge.
Okay. And you found it unusual that Melanie was there at your Christmas holiday for what would be deemed a family holiday. Is that right?
Yes.
Did you happen to recall seeing a gentleman by the name of David Warwick at Christmas that year as well with Melanie?
No.
Okay. Now, you touched on a little bit about the temple, and I don't want to cover this too much, but in terms of the temple, what I don't understand is when someone goes to the temple in your faith, they do that as part of the marriage process in the beginning, right? To sort of the bond, it's a bonding, or you bond with each other, or I'm grasping for the word seal. You're sealing. Mm-hmm. Is that the word?
There's a few things that you can do at the temple. You can go and do something called baptisms for the dead, where you can.
Well, I want to talk about. We'll get there in a minute. And I don't know that we need to spend a lot of time on that. But I'm as part of the marriage process, you seal with each other as part of the marriage process when a couple first gets married, right?
Yeah, we have something where you can be sealed to your spouse for time and all eternity is what we call
it. Okay. And regardless of what happens, you're sealed, even if it means divorce or otherwise, right?
No, not quite. But okay. I mean, we make promises to God. And with those covenants, if you keep those, we believe he gave authority to the person who seals you to be able to stay married even after you die.
Right.
But obviously with any covenant, if you don't keep your promises to God, then you can break that and it's no longer sealed.
Right. And that's something that's important in the LDS faith is to keep your covenant to God, right?
I would hope for most people, if they believe in God and they make a promise with him, that they would want to keep it.
So and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this, but the sealing is also a process in which you, I'm trying to be careful about the way I phrase this, so correct me if I'm wrong. You stand in for somebody else who has passed away or is no longer alive, and you baptize them as a proxy for them. Is that kind of what goes on there?
Sealing or baptizing? Because you said baptize.
Well, sealing. There's a sealing process about being a proxy for someone who's passed on, right?
Yeah, so if I can be sealed to my wife here living, and that's something that I want to do, then I have that option. And for those who passed on, we practice the in proxy is what we call it, but we practice the process of doing that for them so that it could be done here on earth, so that if it's something that they wanted, they could have that option in heaven.
So when they pass on, you're helping them move on to heaven. Is that really what that's all about?
The process would be up to them to choose, right? Okay. But yes, we're going through the process here in behalf of them.
Well, you mentioned the baptism then, and that's what I'm a little confused about. So you baptize people who have passed on as well.
Your Honor, I'm going to object to beyond the scope of direct.
Overruled. So, Mr. Pryor, there needs to be some relevance as well. So that's okay. Narrow.
Well, Judge, I think I'm going to move on. This was more curiosity than was anything else. So okay, let's move on.
Not relevant if it's just curiosity. So
yeah, let's move on then. As part of these fireside issues, have you ever heard of an organization or a group preparing the people?
I have, yes.
And that's an organization that sort of caters to people of your faith about being ready for the second coming. Would that be fair?
I don't know if I would agree with that statement, but so I guess I would say no for me.
Okay. Well, not for you, but in general, for people who are participating in those preparing the people rallies or conventions or firesides. Really, the theme is what to do after the second coming, or preparing in case of an emergency, something of that effect. Would that be fair?
I've never been to something, so I can't testify as to what they believe.
Okay. Is that something that would be considered outside the realm of your faith, or not something you should be looking into as part of your faith?
I mean, I think each person has to decide what they're interested in and what things apply to their faith.
But obviously, if there are some things that you're engaging in that are contrary to the faith, then you don't get to choose that, right?
The church can occasionally come out, right? They, like any organization, and say, hey, these are things that don't apply to our faith.
So having visions, have you heard about people who are blessed with the ability to have divine visions and be able to see events that are occurring in the future?
I have never had any visions, and I don't know anybody who I personally believe that I know personally who's had a vision.
Okay. And then having seances, like conducting a seance, is that something that your wife was doing as part of this back starting in the summer of 2018, was she engaging in seances?
I can't testify to that because I don't know.
Okay. Did she talk to you anything about conducting vibrations and having vibration movements as part of these seances?
She didn't talk about that. Okay.
And the discussion of light and dark, you talked a little bit about Chad Daybell and that there was some discussion about light and dark, right?
But yes.
That's not necessarily inconsistent with your faith. Your faith is talks about it in a number of your publications about light spirits and dark spirits. Isn't that true?
We don't talk about light spirits and dark spirits, no.
No? There's nothing in the faith that talks about light or dark spirits, right?
Nothing in what I've been taught. I mean, it's a large faith. There's a lot of information. So
okay, so you're just not aware of whether that's taught in your faith or not. Is that fair?
I've been going to my church for a really long time, and I've never experienced it.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. Thank you, sir. Appreciate it.
Redirect.
The state has no to redirect, Your Honor.
All right. Are there any? Is the witness perhaps going to be recalled by the state or the defense?
Not by the state.
Not by the defense, Judge.
Okay, that concludes your testimony, Mr. Boudreau. Thank you for appearing today. You're released from any subpoena. You may go ahead and step down.
And Judge, could we have a quick sidebar just on an issue?
Yes. All right, the state can call the next witness.
State calls Officer Ryan Piller, Your Honor.
What was the last name again, Ms. Beatty?
Piller, Your Honor, P-I-L-L-A-R.
Thank you.
Solemnly swear or affirm the testimony you're about to give will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
All right. Before I allow direct here, let me just inquire of the officer now that you're under oath. These trial proceedings have been live streamed and open to the public. Have you been observing any of the testimony that's been provided in trial up to this point?
No, sir.
Okay. And have you discussed with anyone else the testimony they've provided at trial?
No, sir.
All right. Thanks for your responses. Ms. Beatty, you may inquire on direct.
Thank you, Your Honor. Officer Piller, can you please state your full name and then spell your last name?
Yes, it is Ryan Piller. Last name is spelled P as in Paul, I-L-L-A-R.
Where are you currently employed?
I'm employed with the Town of Gilbert Police Department.
And what state is the Town of Gilbert in?
It is in the state of Arizona, Maricopa County.
How long have you been employed by the Gilbert Police Department?
I was employed February 2007 and have been with them for a little over 17 years.
Have you had any other law enforcement jobs prior to your experience with the Gilbert Police Department?
No, ma'am.
Can you briefly describe your training that you've had to become a police officer?
When first hired, I attended an 18-week Arizona Law Enforcement Academy, followed by an 18-week field training. And then I was a patrol officer for 9 years, where I received hundreds of hours of continuous training to include arrest procedures, state laws, firearms training, basic investigations and interrogations. In August of 2016, I lateral moved to our special victims unit within our criminal investigations division, where I was a detective and I received training in interview and interrogation, crime scene. I spent a week-long training with child crimes investigations. I also went to a week-long forensic interview training. In August of 2019, I lateral moved to our violent crimes unit, which is focused on investigating robberies, homicides, and violent crimes. I received another 5-day training with homicide investigations and interviewing techniques, as well as crime scene investigations. I'm now back on patrol work, voluntarily, and working within the school programs within Gilbert, Arizona.
So your current job title is you're an officer with the Gilbert Police Department?
That is correct. I'm a police officer.
What was your job title in 2019?
In 2019, I was a violent crimes detective.
Can you briefly describe your job duties as a violent crimes detective?
As a violent crimes detective, we investigated crimes that are related to violence, death investigations of any kind, homicides, and robberies, anything that would potentially lead to a death or a serious physical injury sustained to a victim.
Were you on duty as a violent crimes detective on October 2nd of 2019?
Yes.
Did you respond to an attempted shooting of a gentleman named Brandon Boudreaux that day?
Yes, I did.
Approximately what time was that?
About 9:13 in the morning is when the initial call for service kicked out.
And did you go to a location?
Yes, 3875 East Phelps Street in Gilbert, Arizona.
And whose residence or what place was that?
It was soon learned that it was the residence of Mr. Brandon Boudreaux.
When you arrived at the scene, what was your role?
Upon arrival to the scene with fellow detectives, I took the primary investigator role, which is the lead detective for that particular investigation.
And when you're the lead detective of any investigation, what are your responsibilities?
Initially, it is to task fellow detectives with their duties. And then as the primary investigator, it's to interview the involved parties, and in this case, the victims and witnesses.
Are part of your duties as a lead detective to make determinations about next steps and directions that the investigation should go?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Now, when you arrived at the scene on October 2nd of 2019, did you make contact with Mr. Boudreaux?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you talk to him without getting into any narrative or any specific statements he made to you? Did you discuss the incident with him?
Yes.
Based on your discussion with him, were you able to ascertain what had happened?
Yes.
Did you have any other discussions with anybody else at the scene or in the area?
Yes. Part of the duty, again, was tasking other detectives with canvassing the areas and speaking with witnesses. There was evidence at the scene, to include in the roadway some shards of glass. Mr. Boudreaux's vehicle was parked in front of his residence. It had evidence that it did, in fact, sustain damage from a projectile. Witnesses at the scene confirmed a vehicle was idling in front of Mr. Boudreaux's residence prior to shooting occurring.
Okay, so let's walk back just a little bit. When you describe seeing Mr. Boudreaux's vehicle, were you able to ascertain where this shooting had occurred, where Mr. Boudreaux was?
Yes.
Where was Mr. Boudreaux when the shooting had occurred?
Mr. Boudreaux was driving his vehicle westbound on Phelps Street, approaching his residence.
And you mentioned that a projectile hit the vehicle. What do you mean by projectile?
Bullet.
Okay. And where was that bullet mark on Mr. Boudreaux's vehicle?
It was up in the A pillar of the door frame, near the windshield. The damage itself actually caused the front driver's side window to fracture, crack, and ultimately shatter. And then there was a hole within the B pillar.
And you personally observed that at the scene?
Yes, ma'am.
After discussing what had happened with Mr. Boudreaux and other individuals at the scene, were you able to get a description of a suspect or suspect vehicle?
Yes.
What was the description that you got?
From Mr. Boudreaux and witnesses, it was a darker color or gray colored Jeep that was parked facing westbound and the eastbound lanes in front of Mr. Boudreaux's residence or near the front of his residence. This Jeep was a Jeep described as a Jeep Wrangler, and specifically it did not have a wheel affixed to the back of the vehicle, which is standard for Jeep Wranglers to have a spare tire affixed to the back of the vehicle.
Did you learn anything about the license plate of that Jeep?
Yes. Additionally, with the color and description of the physicals of it, it was described by Mr. Boudreaux that it was a Texas license plate that was affixed to the back of this vehicle.
Based on your discussions with Mr. Boudreaux and other individuals at the scene and the description of the suspected Jeep, were you able to take that investigation in any specific direction?
Yes.
And what was that?
From interviews and the vehicle description, I reached out to the Chandler Police Department detectives because it was learned that a homicide happened in their jurisdiction in July of 2019. I'm sorry.
I apologize. Can you briefly tell the jury where Chandler is in reference to Gilbert?
Yes. Chandler, Arizona is adjacent to Gilbert, Arizona. We refer to it as a sister city. So it's right next to Gilbert within Maricopa County.
And you described learning about a homicide that had occurred in Chandler. What was the significance of that homicide to your investigation?
So upon learning about the Chandler homicide, it was learned that family members of Brandon's wife at the time, Melanie Boudreau, were present at that Chandler homicide scene, as well as a couple vehicles.
And when you say Brandon's wife, Melanie, do you know what the status of his relationship with Melanie was at the time?
His relationship with Melanie Boudreau at the time is marriage. They were married. They were in the process of a divorce that was near finalization.
Was there anything you learned about that homicide investigation or that, pardon, that death that occurred in Chandler that was applicable to this case or the vehicle specifically that was at the scene?
Yes, the Chandler investigation learned that the decedent was a gentleman by the name of Charles Vallow, who was married to Melanie Boudreau's aunt, Lori Vallow Daybell. Present at that scene as well was Lori's brother, Alexander Cox. It was learned that a vehicle at the Chandler crime scene was a dark-colored gray Jeep with a Texas license plate that was registered to the decedent, Charles Vallow.
At that time, were you able to develop a person of interest with regard to that Jeep?
Yes.
Based on the information that you had as the lead detective, who was that person of interest?
Person of interest was Alexander Cox.
What further steps did you take in that investigation with regard to the Jeep?
From the Jeep information and the license plate that we've confirmed, we reviewed LPR hits. LPR is an acronym for license plate reader. And we were able to track the movements of that Texas license plate on that Jeep with photographs to confirm it was still on the Jeep, moving from the state of Arizona to the state of Idaho.
And did you determine what dates that had occurred?
Yes.
What were those dates?
Those dates were just prior to and after the shooting in Gilbert, Arizona.
Were you able to determine where in Idaho the Jeep had traveled from?
Yes.
Where was that?
It traveled to and from the area of Rexburg, Idaho.
And were you able to determine whether or not Alex Cox had a connection to Rexburg?
Yes, it was soon learned that he was residing in Rexburg, Idaho.
Okay. At some time, did you begin coordinating with law enforcement agencies in the Rexburg area?
Yes. Once it was learned the Jeep was located in the area, we reached out to Rexburg Police Department and Fremont County Sheriff's Office. Sorry.
At some point in time, did yourself or any of the law enforcement agencies you were working with obtain a search warrant on that Jeep?
Yes.
When was that?
The Rexburg Police Department was able to locate and confirm the Jeep was at an apartment complex in their area, and they executed a search warrant in mid-November, November 18th.
Were you present when that search warrant was executed?
Yes.
Can you briefly describe what took place during the execution of that search warrant?
Myself and a crime scene specialist flew up from Arizona directly to Rexburg. We went to Rexburg's property evidence building where the Jeep was secured. I stood by with my crime scene specialist as she processed the vehicle. Processing included taking exterior photographs, opening the vehicle, taking interior photographs, and then she collected physical evidence to include DNA swabs in areas that would have the most contact by the operator, some physical items from within the Jeep, and then collected from the back of the vehicle GSR, which is an acronym for gunshot residue evidence, because we believe this vehicle to be our suspect vehicle and the shooting occurred from outside the back window.
And what did you do with those samples that you retrieved from the vehicle?
These samples were packaged individually from each location where it was collected, and then it was ultimately impounded for evidence and then forwarded to the respective crime labs within Arizona for processing.
And did you have any more, did you do anything else with regard to the Jeep at that time?
No, once the Jeep was processed per the search warrant, it was turned over back to the Rexburg Police Department, where it remained in custody.
At some point in time, did your investigation into the attempted shooting of Brandon Boudreau shift?
Yes.
Why was that?
Because working with Rexburg Police Department, Fremont County Sheriff's Office, and Chandler Police Department still, as well as the FBI, Federal Bureau of Investigation, it was learned that children belonging to Lori Vallow Daybell had not been seen or heard from for quite some time.
When did that shift occur?
It occurred in late, well, shortly after the processing of the Jeep. It was late November. I believe it was November 26th was when the focus really changed.
Did you take any steps in on the Arizona side of things to locate these children?
Yes.
Can you describe those steps that you took?
Myself and fellow detectives began interviewing associates and family members of the involved parties. We set up surveillance to include poll cams, which is discrete cameras that are affixed to a light pole, for example. These cameras were located in locations to monitor friends and family believed to have custody of, at this time, JJ and or Tylee Ryan.
In addition to the poll cams, did you do anything else?
Contacted other family members and associates.
Yes. Were you able to determine whether or not those children were ever in Arizona in November and December of 2019?
Upon review of all surveillance and all interviews, no. There was no indication either child was in the state of Arizona.
Now, at this time in late November and early December of 2019, were you still investigating Alex Cox for the attempted shooting of Brandon Boudreau?
Yes.
What did that investigation look like at that time?
Gilbert Police Department, as well as other agencies, were keeping our eye on Alex Cox. With my investigation in particular, we were tracking his movements.
I apologize for interrupting. When was that?
This was in early December of 2019.
And you were surveilling Alex Cox?
Correct.
How often were you surveilling him?
It was learned that he was back in Arizona, Gilbert in particular, and we were surveying him 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
And in December of 2019, did you stop surveilling Alex Cox for any reason?
December 12th, 2019, yes.
Why did you stop surveilling Alex Cox on that date?
Alex Cox died on the 12th of December of 19.
After Alex Cox died on December 12th of 2019, did you execute a search warrant on his residence or vehicle?
Yes.
What day was that?
It was the same day of his death.
Did you find anything of evidentiary value in Alex Cox's home?
Yes. In his residence, he had multiple munitions and some firearms. He also had indicia to show that he lived in the residence, and ID identification, clothing items. And then he had some literature, multiple books of literature authored by Mr. Chad Daybell.
And did you find anything of evidentiary value in his vehicle?
Yes. There was paraphernalia to include holsters and ammunition within Alex Cox's pickup truck. And there was a letter that was found also within his pickup truck.
What was that letter?
It was a patriarch blessing authored by Chad Daybell.
And who was it directed to?
Alexander Cox.
I may have just a moment, Your Honor.
You may.
And Your Honor, I have no further questions for this witness.
All right. Before cross, just a quick sidebar with counsel, if I may. All right. Thanks, counsel. Ladies and gentlemen of the jury, there's one issue I need to address with the witness and counsel outside of your presence. In lieu of taking a full-on break, if we could just have you retire to the back hallway here for literally 5 minutes or less, we'll come back on and then we'll take our lunch break at noon. So let's just have the jurors excused just very briefly.
All right, please.
There's more to come in the trial of Chad Daybell. Press subscribe so you don't miss any of our continuing coverage right here from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast.